The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Ian Sample. Coming up on the show, how viable is nuclear fusion as an energy source? At ITER in the south of France, seven international partners have pooled their financial and scientific resources to build the biggest fusion reactor in history. Their aim is to resolve critical scientific and technical issues and take fusion to the point where industrial applications can be designed. But concerns have been voiced about the large number of unsolved technological problems relating to fusion and the huge efforts necessary before a large commercial prototype can be designed. Are these ideas about commercial nuclear fusion in the near future just wishful thinking? Also on the show, we have our picks from the week's science news, including the X-ray imaging of ancient Roman scrolls, and the Rosetta mission finds that Comet 67P is fluffy and cracked. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Construction of one of the world's most complex scientific and engineering projects is underway in Marseille. At ITER, standing for International Thermonuclear Experimental Reactor, scientists hope to build a device to test the feasibility of fusion energy. ITER will be twice the size of the largest tokamak fusion experiment currently operating at JET in Oxfordshire, with 10 times the volume of plasma. The idea is to create a burning plasma, in which enough heat from the fusion reaction is retained within the plasma to sustain it for a long duration, taking us closer to realising a fusion energy source. I'm joined in the studio by Nicola Davis, commissioning editor of Observer Tech Monthly, and Professor Steve Cowley, director of the Cullum Centre for Fusion Energy. And down the line from Switzerland, we have Dr. Michael Dittmar, a researcher at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology. Welcome to you all. Steve, could you start off by telling us how nuclear fusion is different from the nuclear fission, which is happening in nuclear power plants today?
With nuclei, there are two forces that act between nuclei. And they give rise to an interesting thing, which is the most stable nucleus is a middle-sized nucleus, iron, right in the middle of the chemical periodic table. And nuclei want to join together if they're too small, and they want to split it in half if they're too big. So fission is the splitting of the very big, like uranium, and fusion is the joining together of light nuclei of atoms. And stars do this to make all the elements that we're made of. Mm-hmm. So they join hydrogens together to make helium, they join heliums together to make carbon. It's a rather complicated process with many steps in it, but that's essentially the process in which stars join these light nuclei together. And when they do, it releases energy, and it's what keeps stars hot.
And so this would be a fantastic new energy source if we can get it to work. Does it have the concerns that, you know, nuclear fission obviously produces waste, which people get very concerned about? Can you talk me through sort of nuclear fusion? What are the byproducts from that? Is this something which is technically a clean energy?
Okay, so the reaction we'd like to do is a reaction between two kinds of hydrogen, deuterium, which is heavy hydrogen, and tritium, which is super heavy hydrogen. And it makes helium and a neutron. Now, helium, of course, is a very benign byproduct. You might want to fill balloons with it. But the neutron that is produced in the reaction can make some secondary radioactivity. Our calculations of reactor design suggest that the amount of radioactivity that you produce will be about 1,000 times less than a typical nuclear reactor, and it will decay to the levels of a lump of coal in about 200 years. So it's very clean. It doesn't have the danger of a runaway reaction. Mm-hmm. And we have very abundant fuel sources on Earth. We have millions of years of fusion fuel on Earth. So in many ways, it's the perfect way to make energy. Except one thing, it is really hard to do.
It always sounds very promising, and as you say, it's very hard to do. What are the projects that are currently underway? So we know that there's this huge reactor being built in the south of France called ITER, which we'll come to in a minute. But there are other projects and experiments that have been running for some time, both in the UK and around the world. Can you just talk me through sort of where we're at with this?
So ITER was based on results that came from JET, which is in Oxfordshire, the laboratory which I'm the director of. And JET is a European machine. And in 1997, we managed to get very briefly, for 2 seconds, 16 megawatts of fusion power from reactions inside it. Now, that at the time, jet was at about 230 million degrees in the centre. And what was happening was that the deuterium and the tritium nuclei were flying around at immense velocities, running into each other and occasionally sticking and producing helium. And that was producing extra energy of 16 megawatts. So we got the conditions for fusion in jet. But what you'd like to do is have a self-sustained fusion reaction, where fusion produces enough heat to sustain the reaction and it will burn. That's the idea of ITER. It's basically jet times two. And the idea is that, you know, when we get it up to temperature, it'll start to make fusion. The fusion will make heat, which will keep the fuel hot at temperatures between 200 and 300 million degrees. And it will continue to make fusion, and all we'll have to do is to feed it with deuterium and tritium. Typically, the baseline performance would be about half a gigawatt of power for 400 seconds, although now projections suggest that we would get more power than that for thousands of seconds out of ITER.
So ITER is an international collaboration. It's sort of everyone's on board with it. We've got countries from Europe, we've got America, and South Korea, I believe, is also involved. So countries all over the world. And it's based in the south of France. So what's actually like down there? They're building it at the moment. It's sort of under construction.
They're building it at the moment. It's a bit of a nightmare in that you've got an international project with many goals and many partners and too many interfaces. And, you know, it's going rather slowly and it's over budget. But, you know, I was down there 2 weeks ago and progress is being made. It's a fantastic piece of technology. And as it comes together, I think we'll get more and more excited about it. I'm excited because it will be the first time we ever made that self-sustained fusion burn on Earth. And when that happens, it's a historic moment in science. And then we have to really address the issue if we can make commercial fusion power out of that, right? Because ITER will not make electricity. ITER will make a fusion burn. And after that, we have to really address the issue of, can we make it commercially possible?
I think this would be a good time to talk to Michael Dietmar, who's joining us on the line from Switzerland. Michael, you have a few points that you'd like to talk about with regards to turning nuclear fusion from a sort of experimental setup into a commercially viable scenario. Do you want to just talk us through some of the concerns that you have?
Yes, sure. I mean, I think it's not true that we have the fuel available for millions of years on Earth. I mean, what is being mixed is that the only fusion reaction we can imagine on Earth is deuterium plus tritium. Now, tritium actually does not exist in sizable quantities, and in the moment, the world inventory is something like 20 kilograms. So what is being referred to is that it could be made in principle out of some reaction with a neutron reacting with lithium, and out of this, then we get the tritium somewhere out of this blanket, which by itself is a huge volume, and this actually is the real process we have to consider. And as far as all published papers show, there is absolutely no viable process has been identified so far to do this. So I would highly recommend to go into the details a little bit in the discussion on how actually the tritium production is supposed to be made in a self-sufficient way in a future fusion reactor.
We've, for, you know, 30 or 40 years, calculated the behavior of the breeding system, which is the neutron comes out of the fusion reaction and it has to strike a lithium and make a tritium out of lithium. Obviously, if you're not going to run out of tritium, you have to make slightly more tritium than one for one. And it typically, if you went a neutron went into pure lithium, it would make about 1.6 tritium per neutron that came out. So that would be terrific. The lithium-7 reaction is what makes natural lithium have a breeding ratio of 1.6, right? And because there's more lithium-7 than lithium-6. Because at high energies, that is a viable reaction. Now, if you structure your blanket in the right way, and we've done many, many detailed calculations of blankets, we think we can get the breeding ratio above one. In fact, we think we produce too much tritium and we have to poison the reaction to start with so that we don't overproduce tritium. Now, right. This is a calculation and we need to do experiments. And ITER is going to do 6 blanket prototypes in order to test these ideas.
Well, just let me quote from Professor Abdu when he gave his talk to the USA Fusion Energy Science Advisory Committee in June 3rd, 2014. And he says, compelling examples from recent discoveries show that blankets designed with current knowledge of phenomena and data will not work. I mean, this is just half a year ago. And you are saying, so either Professor Abdu is lying or something is sort of, we are missing some scientific facts. And I know, I have seen the publications from Professor Abdu on these, on his detailed simulations, and they show exactly, with very detailed arguments, that in the current moment, it is absolutely not functioning.
Okay, well, there are simulations that calculate that we can get the tritium breeding ratio above one. Now, it's an experiment. You know, we do it on ITER and we try it out. And it is something that we are aware of, and we've been aware of for about 40 years, that it is an issue that you have to do. Now, one of the issues in order to mitigate it, of course, is if you run lean in tritium, you get some neutrons from the DD reactions, and you can get a few percent out of the DD reactions, and this can tip you over the edge. So there are a number of tricks you can play. We don't think we have to do them yet.
Michael, so there's obviously some controversy over the tritium breeding process and some questions there that still need to be ironed out for us to move forward, especially commercially. Is there anything else that we should be thinking about with ITER?
Oh, there are absolutely incredible amount of details which are missing. For example, what we have absolutely no idea how actually the energy of the neutron is being transferred to some medium which can eventually provide the heat for a generator. It's really the basic physics process of the neutron. I mean, when neutrons interact, they have a very small cross-section for elastic scattering, but a relatively large cross-section for inelastic scattering with other nuclei. Mm-hmm. As was very well said also in the introduction by Steve, he says, well, there is a considerable radioactivity induced by these neutrons because they make nuclear reactions. And then some of these neutrons unfortunately absorbed. So the question is actually how is it even imaginable that the 14 MeV neutrons being produced coming out of the reactor core are actually heating up something? And this is very interesting to compare this with a standard fission reactor, where these things are actually very trivial to some extent. To transfer further heat to a liquid, to water, and then operate a steam generator.
And so, Steve, can you sort of talk me through that a bit then? So how do we turn the energy we're getting out from a nuclear fusion reactor into energy we can actually harness and use?
Obviously, when the 14 MeV neutron comes out of the plasma, we will want to extract the energy from it, and we want to breed tritium. And that's what the blanket designs are designed for. It collides, and it accelerates other nuclei. That's transferred into heat, and we have coolant flowing through it. Now, we've actually made blanket segments, and we've passed just very, very few 14 MeV neutrons through them. Mm-hmm. They agree with the calculations that we deposit the heat in there and that the activation of the blanket is in agreement with the calculations. These were experiments done in Frascati in Rome. You know, this is an experiment, so we're going to try these things on ITER, and as we get up to full power, there probably will be some surprises.
Yeah.
And I can't guarantee that everything will work, but in the calculations, they do at the moment.
So is it the case that you take the energy and it sort of heats a fluid and that turns, I mean, it's sort of in...
Yes. There are two basic blanket designs that everybody is investigating. Mm-hmm. One is that the lithium is in a ceramic form, essentially in pebbles, lithium titanate, and you throw helium or another coolant gas through that, and the gas gets hot because the lithium will get hot because you're depositing the energy of the neutron into the lithium, and therefore that produces heat, and then you power a turbine from that. The other one is a liquid lithium lead eutectic, so it's a liquid, and it's designed to have lead, which makes it non-flammable, and that in which you produce the lithium in the liquid, and it's also the coolant, the liquid. It flows out of the machine, and it transfers heat out of the machine, and then you power a turbine from it. And then you pass it through a porous pipe in which the tritium diffuses out of it. And one of the questions, and Professor Dittmar has highlighted this, although it's something we're working on very much in Germany at the moment, is how fast can we get the tritium out of that coolant?
I mean, if we have a huge volume, something like at least 500 cubic meters, so how do you actually intend to get something like a few kilograms of tritium out of it, out of this cubic meter.
Well, one of the nice things about tritium is it's nice and mobile, so it diffuses out of the ceramic very efficiently into the helium, and then it also diffuses through certain porous media. Those designs have been tried at Karlsruhe.
As far as I know, tritium or hydrogen is actually a very reactive element, and it's very difficult to contain even. So if you have it over 500 cubic meters, such a tiny amount of something like a few kilograms you want to get out, I mean, this is more a problem for chemistry and not for a physicist.
Well, the models of this have been made at places like Karlsruhe and in other places where we've studied the diffusion of the tritium out of it. You know, this is experimental science, and we're working on it.
But as you write in your own publication, you know that the design and prototype of these fusion blankets is just on paper, has never been tested under real conditions. And you write, this is a huge challenge.
It is.
It is a huge challenge,
I agree.
It's a huge challenge, so I would say maybe before we make strong statements, perhaps the first step would be to do these practical experiments and demonstrate that it's possible. And in your own publication, you write that actually we need another facility in order to do this. Now, unfortunately, this facility will cost something at least of $1 billion, and absolutely nothing is being developed on this in the moment.
That's not true. In fact, now the Chinese have decided to take up that challenge. It's a machine called CFETR, which the Chinese will build to go online in the 2030s, which will have a complete blanket surrounding it in order to test these issues.
So it's far after ITER has eventually produced something. And you write in your own publication that demo should be available by 2040. So if you have not even tested anything before, so how can you even design a demo product?
Well, it's an interesting question. You try to do these things in parallel. I was hoping that we might get some results on the blanket by the end of the 2020s. I think that's unlikely now because of the delays in ITER, and we may be seeing demo. The current European roadmap is to get demo and some first electricity from fusion before 2050.
Perhaps I can just dive in there and ask Ian Sample. You've been very quiet here and listening, and perhaps you've got some questions that you'd like to also ask Stephen.
I did, actually, and I wondered, it was something you mentioned early on, Steve, about how you said that you couldn't get runaway reactions with the fusion-type reactor, and I wondered if you might just elaborate on that a little bit, because certainly after the tsunami hit in Japan, we saw a lot of political problems against fission reaction nuclear power in Japan and in Germany. And, you know, there's always been this concern, and it's often overblown, but a concern over nuclear power reactors, that people think, well, what happens if someone flies a plane into one of them, or if they go into a meltdown procedure? Are fusion reactors sort of fundamentally safer for some reason of the physics?
Yes, I mean, there's a simple reason, which is that the amount of fuel that you actually put in the device at any one time is less than a gram, 0.1 gram, 0.2 gram, something like that, in the machine. And so if that were released, or that all burnt at once, that wouldn't be a big deal because it wouldn't escape the containment. The problem in fission is you have months or years worth of fuel right inside the reactor. There are potential risks from that. But with fusion, there aren't those risks. Now, it's perfectly possible to design a dangerous fusion reactor which would have a big fire, right? But it's more of a conventional fire than anything else. We are, in our reactor designs, trying to design it so it's as safe as possible. So there's no fire risk, there's no release risk, etc. We want to start out on this process of making fusion reactors with things that are already very, very safe.
I'm interested in how the politics is working at the moment, because we have a lot of countries here who aren't best friends, let's say. We've got the US, we've got Russia, we've got China and India in there. I know these aren't all falling out, but there's a lot of different countries we have to bring along or have to collaborate on ITER. A lot of these countries aren't in the best financial shape, but this project is taking a lot of money. So how do you see the situation from here? Is this chugging along nicely? Are people holding their nerve, if you like, and saying, no, this is important, we are going to build it, even though, as you've said a few times, this is experimental science? Or is this actually quite a fragile coalition at the moment?
Obviously, the cost has gone up considerably, roughly a factor of 3, maybe 2.5 to 3. That puts a great strain on the coalition of partners. I think that the partners you might think would be difficult are the ones that are most keen. Like the Chinese have delivered their part of the project beautifully. The Russians have delivered their part of the project beautifully. We're struggling in Europe to deliver our part, which is very challenging, and we're over cost and we're behind schedule. And that, of course, puts strains in the political coalition. It's very difficult building a machine where you've got so many interfaces between different countries and different organizations and industry, etc. I'm disappointed we're not moving faster because I would like to see that fusion burn soon. For me, the scientific challenge of fusion will have been conquered when we get that fusion burn. As Michael points out, there's a lot of challenges after that for economic fusion. But for science, it would be a wonderful moment when we get a burn.
Michael, can I just ask you, you have some strong objections to this whole idea. Do you think that the experiment's just not worth trying, that they should just pack up and close it down, put the money somewhere else?
Well, actually, my point is that we should first solve these basic questions about the tritium breeding and so on and have such a facility. This would be the minimum. And this was known already 20 years ago, and nobody talked about it. And this, I think, is the main problem in this whole energy situation problem we are facing today. All these kind of problems were hidden, and then sort of slowly they come up, and then, oh, actually, yeah, we know it's a factor of three more expensive, it's more this and that. But actually, I would also like to address one point. I mean, certainly there is no huge environmental danger or radioactivity, but there is a danger that the whole precision apparatus gets destroyed by such a little incident, and then 15 billion euros or dollars or whatever currency you use will disappear like nothing, and you have to start from zero again. Now, there are many, many little things which can happen in such a precision experiment, and this, I think we know already, is basically impossible to perform. So I would say a real scientific approach to all these problems should start from the beginning, and with a facility where you can really test these basic things of neutron tritium production chain.
Can I just dive in there and ask a question which takes us slightly away from fusion, but ask, as you say, it is a huge price tag. We all agree that. No one's going to quibble that this is a lot of money. How does this fit with the sort of roadmap for renewables, which obviously a lot of people would champion perhaps as being more immediately realistic goal perhaps? I mean, Steve, how do you feel about, is it taking money away from another worthwhile pursuit?
It depends where you look, where money is spent, right? The amount of money spent on renewables research is modest, but the amount of money spent on price supports for renewables is tens of billions a year. And so it vastly bigger than what's being spent on fusion. The worldwide market for energy is 7 trillion a year. 7 trillion, you know. This is 15 billion over 25, 30 years, mm-hmm. right? I mean, so it's a drop in the ocean. We should be spending more money on energy research because our whole civilization will come to a grinding halt unless we solve some of these problems.
Michael, how do you feel about renewables? Do you think renewables are the way forward?
Actually, I mean, just on this, right? I think we should really separate research issues, energy research issues, from energy production. Now, if our current system is totally unsustainable, as we seem very well to agree on, then somehow I would argue that this energy market budget, which should be highly taxed in order to give money to such future research projects. Now, we have fundamental science questions, which is obviously the science budget. And this depends on how much society wants to give for fundamental science. But this is very different from engineering questions. So I would say energy research should get actually funding directly from some kind of taxes on the actual energy market.
And do you think that we should be pushing more renewables, or do you think that fusion is, you know, ultimately, and if we can crack some of these problems that, you know, we've been talking about, do you think that fusion is actually where we should be looking for our energy source in the years to come?
Well, I think we first need to figure out what research really needs to be done. And in my view, the first questions which should be addressed at a highly scientific level is the resource question, how many resources are really existing and how much we can exploit. Then we should work on efficiencies. Then we should work very, very strongly on the reduction of our needs, because we waste incredible amount of energy for all kind of things which we really don't need. And then sort of we should figure out how to to solve the problems which we have created already, and which is a long-lasting legacy for future generations. So if you want to really be serious, we should start talking about this. And in order to give you an idea, for example, you can look at the British Petroleum about remaining resources in Western Europe or in United Kingdom. So we put the heads of our own countries, and you find, for example, the oil resources remaining for the United Kingdom at current production is about 10 years, mm-hmm. for gas 7 years, and for coal is given like 18 years.
Mm.
In the European Union, basically, you get the same numbers. And these are the time scales we have to deal with. We should also deal with the real CO2 problem. Now, just to remind you, last week, on average, we passed the 400 parts per million. Actually, 2.7 parts per million more per year. And the goal, which was supposed to be not exceeded, was 450 ppm by the end of the century. Now, at current rates, we reach this within 20 years.
So we've obviously got a fairly pressing problem here that we need to deal with. I think we can all agree on that. You have one final question that you wanted to ask Michael and Steve. Do you want to just jump in with that?
Yeah, and it's possibly more one for Steve, although Michael let me know. I mean, I didn't want to do a sort of technical analysis of this one, but I am interested in the other approaches to fusion that are happening as well as ITER. And in the one that comes to mind is the National Ignition Facility in the US, where they're trying to do work with sort of lasers and whole realms. And I'm wondering, is that direction, that approach to fusion, looking more or less promising than the way ITER is hoping to do it? Is that a parallel way to do this?
The laser approach is a little bit further back because we don't yet know how big the laser has to be in order to provide the energy to squash the fuel.
Right.
So in laser fusion, you have a little pellet of fuel in a very tricky way, which I won't describe. You use the laser to basically squash that pellet down to about 1,000 times normal density. And the deuterium and the tritium in the middle then gets to fusion conditions, and it burns before it disassembles. In a way, it's like a little bomb. It has all the same problems of breeding tritium and things like that. But the real question is, how big a laser do we need to drive this with in order to do this? If you wanted to make energy from it, you'd have to do it 6 times a second, and you'd have to do it with reliability, etc. Now, it was hoped that NIF might be big enough to do that, and it hasn't yet worked out. And we don't quite understand the physics of what are going on in those implosions. They've made some progress, but they don't yet think they know how to make it ignite. Now, in the fusion business, the question is which problem to solve first. We have decided, I think, that we want to get the fusion reactions to work first, and then we'll work on the engineering. If we wanted fusion really fast, we'd work on them all at once.
Mm.
But we don't have that kind of money. In the NIF case, what they're doing is they're slowly moving towards trying to find out whether they can get ignition, right? And they should be given 10 or 15 years more operation time to really have a look at that. It's a magnificent laser, and they've done some spectacular experiments, but they didn't make it.
Mm. It sounds like there's exciting, if difficult times ahead for fusion. So we look forward to seeing what's going to happen down at ITER. And thank you very much to Steve Cowley and to Michael Dietmer for joining us for this discussion.
And you can read more about ITER in a piece written by Alok Jar, our former colleague and podcast presenter, in The Observer yesterday.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the simple yet powerful website building platform. As a Guardian podcast listener, it goes without saying that you're a clever clogs. The good news is that building your own professional website with Squarespace is easy. Whether the site you need is for a small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog, getting started takes seconds. Go to squarespace.com today and show support for this podcast and get 10% off. Use the offer code Guardian.
Let's turn to some news now. Ian, there's been some interesting stories in the news this week. One that caught my eye was how scientists are using X-rays to take a peek inside some Roman scrolls. Can you tell me a bit about that?
Yeah, I quite like this one. It was from some Italian researchers, and they had done a study on some ancient Roman scrolls which were found in a room that was a library in the huge villa in Herculaneum, which is one of the Roman cities that was destroyed when Mount Vesuvius went up in AD 79, along with Pompeii. This city was wiped out. And these scrolls were part of this lavish library. It may have belonged to the father-in-law of Julius Caesar. They don't particularly know who owns the villa. But you have all these scrolls, hundreds of them, that were profoundly charred and couldn't be read because of that. They can't unwrap them. If you try and unwrap them, they fall apart. They're incredibly fragile. So what do you do? And if you want to try and read them, these things can be 15 meters long if you try and unravel it. So they've used an X-ray procedure where what they try and do is try and pick up a difference in contrast between the carbon of the ink against the carbon and the rest of the papyrus fibers, because these are written on papyrus. Now, you can't do that very easily. So what they've done with the technique and the way they've tweaked it is, instead of just looking at the kind of difference in colour, if you like, the absorption of the X-rays, they're looking at how the ink alters the refraction of the X-rays more than the papyrus. And they've managed, using this, to get a decent enough contrast to start reading out the very first letters.
So the first letters, I mean, are we talking whole words here, whole sentences? Are we getting any, what kind of insights are we getting from this?
The insights are wildly exciting, I have to say. When I started reading this paper, I thought, oh, maybe they found a map that takes them to some treasure, and there's going to be this, you know, alien civilization. Well, you know, I had high hopes, and ridiculously high hopes, that there would be something lovely and intelligible from it. But this is really early stages. And they've pieced together the Greek capital letters spelling out a word that means would fall in the language. They've found other words that mean would say, that phrase. And then other little snippets. They've got the and a word meaning to deny or for. And it's all very preliminary at the moment. There's an awful lot they've got to do. But they're starting to get there, and they're hoping to get onto a more powerful X-ray machine, a synchrotron, to try and do more. And this paper may have been a means of trying to get more funding to get onto that next project and try and read more of this. Because you've got to think that one of the scrolls in particular that they looked at had been not only burned by the blast, which they reckon reached 320°C, it was actually flattened by the pressure of the blast. So these things are incredibly tightly coiled up, so you have to use your X-rays to not only see the text, but work out what text is at what level, a layer through this kind of Swiss roll kind of thing, and then reconstruct it by kind of unraveling it on a computer in a sense. So they've got loads of the characters that they can identify from the Greek alphabet, but actually putting this together into intelligible sentences is a way off yet.
And yet they claim that they might have found who wrote these words. I mean, how likely is that?
They're quite excited about this, because there have been some previous work looking at the kind of handwriting that was used by particular writers in different stages, and they were classified according to particular quirks of their handwriting. Now, obviously, a lot of people would write things, but this was a library where they knew that there were a lot of this sort of Epicurean philosopher texts, and some of the quirks of the letters, the way the letters were written, they think matches some previous texts that had been looked at that were written by a guy called Philodemus around the first century BC. And so they're pitching that as like a potential author of this. But one of the things about this kind of research is it's going to be really hard for anyone to say you're wrong, because no one's really going to know. But I like this. It was a nice way into trying to understand what was in this library, because it's the only library to survive from antiquity. It's the only thing they've really got from that part of the ancient world.
So moving on, we've also got some interesting news coming out from the Rosetta mission. This is the first sort of papers that have been coming out since the excitement of the Philae lander. So Patrick can talk me through, what are the findings? What are they saying that they found?
So there were a batch of papers that came out in the journal Science, and these are the first published scientific results from the Rosetta spacecraft, the orbiting spacecraft around Comet 67P, to be published since Rosetta caught up and started going around the comet. So there was some work that came out on approach and all the rest of it. But these are the first scientific results from the close-in inspection, if you like. They give you the first detailed picture of the comet. So one of the things that caught my eye is the density of the comet is about half that of water. And they say it's kind of fluffy. It's about 70 to 80% porous. So it's incredibly fragile, if you like, this 4 kilometer wide block of ice and dust. It's got a coating on it, a dusty coating on it. Another thing I liked was they're in very early in terms of the activity of the comet. The comet is hurtling towards the sun at the moment. Around August this year, it's going to be at its closest approach to the sun, when it'll be at its most active, because all of this ice will be subliming off. At the moment, they're starting to see it become active, and a lot of the activity is concentrated on this neck of the comet. And you'll remember the comet has this funny shape where you have a kind of people say it's a bit like a rubber duck. It has this like smallish head and then this thin neck and then the body. And a lot of the activity is coming from that neck region. Another thing I quite liked was that they have a camera on board called OSIRIS. And one of the things it picked up was on this neck region, there's an enormous crack in it. It's hundreds of meters long. The neck itself is only about a kilometer wide. And this crack that they've seen runs for at least a few hundred meters. There's some they can't see because it's in shade, but they'll be able to see that after May when it's not in shade anymore. They don't particularly know how deep the crack is. They know some of it's filled in with dust, but it's about a meter wide in places. And it is running perpendicular to the sort of axis of the neck, if you like. And they think that the crack came about because of sort of flexural stresses in the rotation of the comet. And because you've got the activity there as well, it may be that this comet will actually break apart at that point. It's impossible to say when, but it might break apart at that position. And I thought that was a really interesting aspect. Something else they saw, which was really curious, is there are these pits that they see, which are a couple of hundred meters across. They've seen hundreds of these pits all over the comet. And they're actually nice and cylindrical. Inside, on the walls of them, they kind of have these things they're calling goosebumps. These kind of like bumpy little sort of ridges, if you like, on the inside. And a lot of the activity of the comet, which means where a lot of the gas and water vapor is coming from, is from these pits or from cliff faces. Because when the sunlight comes and heats those up, the dust that comes off falls away and gives you some fresh material to heat up and so on. So that's how you get the activity coming off. Whereas if you look at the body of the comet, it's a lot flatter and smoother, and that is harder to heat up because it's covered in dust, which insulates it thermally. So they found these strange pits with these sort of goosebump features inside that they're calling about, where a lot of the activity is going on. So that what this really amounts to is they are now learning an awful lot more about a comet as it starts going and becoming more active than they've ever had before. One thing they're planning to do is to fly through the jets that are coming off the comet and try and analyze the particles coming off. And that's going to be quite an exciting thing to do, just in terms of how on earth you can do that with a spacecraft around a comet. So we're going to get some really interesting details of what is physically coming off the comet by flying through it.
And is there any hope for the little Philae lander that's sitting on that comet, we hope, somewhere?
It's hard to say, but I have spoken to some scientists who are actually quite confident that as the comet gets nearer to the sun, that the Philae lander will start getting enough light onto its solar panels to power itself up and maybe send back a bit more. Now, I don't know how hopeful they are, those scientists are. I don't know how sort of outlierish their opinions are, but there certainly seems a sense to me that people haven't given up on Philae coming back to life yet. That's all we have for you this week. A big thank you to Steve Cowley, Michael Dittmar and Nicola Davis. From me, Ian Sample, and all the science team, thanks for listening.